What most worries me, particularly since October 7th, is the incitement and the indoctrination of the Egyptian people, that is more than 110 million people, against Israel and the Jewish people. The indoctrination and the incitement in Egypt, I would dare say, is by far the worst in the entire Arab Sunni world. That's quite a statement to make.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants truly to understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond headlines. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and your co-host. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center focused on strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances and partnerships. Every week, we will go beyond the headlines and the noise to bring you insight and analysis of what's really happening in the Middle East, both the critical issues on the national security agenda and also the trends and the opportunities taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on all the major platforms, and this way you'll be able to keep up to date and be ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. And we would love to read your comments and answer your questions and hear your suggestions. Send them all to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
This week, we have a very special guest, Ruth Wasserman Lande. Ruth served as Israel's deputy ambassador in Egypt. She served as the international affairs advisor to Israeli President Shimon Peres. She served as the international affairs advisor to the Federation of Local Councils. And then she served as a member of Knesset in the Benny Gantz's Blue and White Party. And today she's a senior fellow at the Misgav Institute. And we sort of do a grand tour of the Middle East, looking at all the different countries on Israel's borders and really trying to create some insight and some order into all the various situations and conflicts that Israel currently finds itself in.
But first, let's talk about the news. We've had a really bad week for relations between Israel and the Christian world, with numerous incidents creating tensions on that front. The first one that went public, even though it's not actually the first one that happened, but the first one that became public is when Israeli shells hit and damaged the Catholic Church in Gaza. It's the only church in Gaza, from what I understand, or the only remaining church, remaining when Hamas took over, not remaining because of the IDF. It had been pretty much unscathed until last week. It had even been used to shelter people for a long time. There's only about 200 Christians, or at least 200 known Christians, in Gaza. But there are, at certain points in the war, there were hundreds more people sheltering in the church and receiving food and aid there. That was not the case last week, but there was significant damage, from what I understand, and three people were severely wounded, including the priest. And this caused a huge controversy. Prime Minister Benjamin, controversy is not even the right word. Yeah, like it's a very terrible incident. And in Israel, nobody wanted that to happen. The IDF said it was a mistake. Prime Minister Netanyahu immediately went and apologized to the Pope. He called the Pope. The Pope still said that Israel attacked the church, which I would say is, you know, and the Cardinal of Jerusalem, Cardinal Pizzaballa, said that Israel targeted the church, which, at least according to what Israel and the IDF are saying, is not accurate. Asher, I know you have some insight for us as someone who frequently does IDF reserve duty about what soldiers are told when it comes to churches and other religious sites.
There's two aspects, I think, of this story and of the sort of narrative that was created around an incident that did or didn't happen with the church in Taba. There is the Israel-Christian relations element of the story, then the military aspect of the story. Now, from a military perspective, as someone who served in Lebanon and in other areas, there are the soldiers on the map that you have. As a soldier, they're very, very clearly marked religious buildings, humanitarian buildings, hospitals, and there are very clear instructions about avoiding harming those buildings, avoiding taking sort of gaps or spaces between where you're operating and those buildings in order to ensure safeguards, ensure that they are not harmed. Now, it is challenging in an operational environment if you have, we don't know exactly the details of this incident, and as you mentioned, Israel has apologized, but when you have terrorists who make use of these hospitals, schools, religious buildings, churches, when you have terrorist infrastructure that is stored in these buildings, when you have a fast-moving battle, things are changing and terrorists are popping up, there is room for error, certainly for human error, and that appears to be what happened in this case, which, by the way, has happened in many other cases around the world. For example, in Iraq in March 2003, when the Americans were invading Baghdad, they were attempting to bomb the Ministry of Information, and they accidentally caused damage to St. George's Church in Baghdad. So it seems clear to me that Israel has no interest in harming the Catholic Church in Gaza or any religious sites, but in a dynamic battle against terrorists that make use of these humanitarian sites for their terror purposes or operate in the vicinity of them, these kinds of unfortunate events can happen. On the other hand, we know that in Gaza, many, many mosques, for example, were used to house weapons, used as the entrance points for tunnels, intentionally, right? Hamas understands the sensitivity that exists towards religious sites, and therefore it intentionally takes advantage of that sensitivity and puts its infrastructure or its fighters in the vicinity of the church. It's possible that's what happened in this case. It's possible that's a case of human error, but it certainly was not an intent by Israel to harm the church in Gaza.
I think the fact that the church has basically been unscathed up until now shows that Israel has been trying to avoid it, right? Because Gaza, you know, Israel has demolished many, many buildings in Gaza. Like, they're not hesitant when there's a terrorist. But I also want to talk about another church, this one in near Jerusalem, in a Palestinian town called Taibe, there's an Israeli Arab town with the same name, so it could be confusing, but these are the Palestinians, and it's a very Christian area, and there's an ancient church there. And leaders of the church there went to the media and said that there was an arson attack on the church. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, went out to the area of the church to visit the church leaders. And he said, you know, that this is horrible and any kind of crime should be investigated. He didn't actually blame anyone. He didn't actually say who the perpetrators are. But of course, on social media, you know, Palestinian and pro-Palestinian people on social media immediately blamed extremist settlers. And then you saw the international media start blaming extremist settlers. And they were using this video. Did you see the video, Asher?
I did.
Yeah. Of Israelis with leaf blowers in a field that's on fire. And they said, oh, they're using the leaf blowers to try to make the fire like higher or to push the fire in the direction of the church. Now, the Israelis, as it turns out, said, no, this is how you put out a brush fire. I'm not a firefighter, not an expert, but this is what they're saying. Like, they said, this is our grazing land where we graze our cattle. And the leaf blower is what we use to put out fires. We did not, you know, light the fires. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean that no Israeli lit the fires, but there's even more evidence. First of all, there were multiple police reports coming from Israelis at the fires, as well as from the church. And so it's starting to look a lot like, oh, and also the church was not damaged. The fire was not actually in the church. It was in the fields next to the church. But you would think, there's all these aerial pictures out now that you can see online of the church. Like, it's a very open area that anyone who was on the Israeli farm that's nearby could just walk right up to the church and burn it down if, God forbid, that's what someone wanted to do. So it just doesn't look like an arson attempt anymore. And yet, you know, what is it? A lie can run 1,000 miles before the truth even gets its shoes on, whatever that quote is.
At least it's pants on.
The story is, it's pants on. Okay. So the story is out, right? And it, like, look, do we have like the exact complete evidence of what happened there? No, but there's not complete. There's nothing even close to evidence of what those people are claiming, that Israelis started the fire. And it goes back to what we talked about in the past, where people keep jumping to talk about violent settlers. And it's not that there isn't a small group of violent extremists in Judea and Samaria. They exist, but it's just become this almost this blood libel with which to paint, you know, paint a large group of people with a broad brush.
Exactly. And you had, because of the event in the Catholic Church in Gaza and then this event in Taiba, there became a sort of international discourse. And this week we're talking about Israel's actions against the Christians. And we saw across the Western media, but also I on the American right, some, I think it was the Daily Wire with a monologue, "You've lost me, you're losing me because of your attacks on Christians." And even Mike Huckabee was complaining. And so it's to quote, Mike Huckabee tweeted recent, following up on the investigations that you mentioned, he tweeted, "Investigation reveals no damage to ancient church in Taiba and investigation of origin of fire continues. I have not attributed the cause of fire to any person or group, as we don't know for sure. The press has. I have said that regardless, it was a crime and deserves consequences." Now, if there was an attempted arson attack on the church, it was certainly a crime and it deserves consequences. And there are certainly cases of crimes, harassment, arson by Jewish extremists against Christian sites in Israel. We should recognize that. And I personally believe the Israeli police need to do a much better job of ending that and clamping that down. But if we take a step back, the Christian population in Israel since Israel's founding till today has grown 5 times over. There's no other country in the Middle East that can say anything close to that. In fact, Christian citizens of Israel have the highest rate of success on the national high school exams of any population in the country.
Yeah.
And they are overrepresented.
The best schools in Israel are the Catholic schools.
And they're overrepresented as engineers or represented as medical professionals. They've achieved the highest, the Supreme Court, many others, Knesset, many other high positions in Israeli society. On the other hand, in the West Bank, certainly in Gaza, but in the West Bank as well, the numbers have dwindled because of ongoing persecution, both explicitly and day-to-day. For example, in that same village in Taiba, I believe it was in September 2005, a mob of local Muslims burned 13 houses of Christians, and the PA, which knew just exactly what was going on, took its time. It only arrived a few hours later once the houses of the Christians had been burned. Bethlehem has gone from being 85% Christian to being about 10% Christian. So the differences in the way that Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and certainly the authority, the Islamist authorities in Hamas, are relating to their Christian populations couldn't be clearer. Certainly, if there were crimes, they should be investigated. If there were mistakes, they should be corrected. But I would also urge people in the West who are looking at this, before you reach conclusions or declare that Israel is losing your support, go a little bit beyond the headlines, a little bit beyond the spin, and look a little bit deeper into the facts of what actually happened.
So I want to add one more thing in here. There was this letter last week that Ambassador Huckabee wrote to the Interior Minister and a few others, top Israeli officials, complaining that workers for certain Christian organizations were having difficulty getting visas to come into Israel because of a change in the visa system. This got leaked to the press. From my understanding and my reporting, it was not from Huckabee himself. He wanted to, you know, deal with this privately behind closed doors. And it was also sort of misreported. Like, they would write Christian groups, right? Which would imply like pilgrims, tourists, right? And, you know, and there's like, I don't know, a million or a couple million that come to Israel every year. And that's just not the case. It's long-term visas. It's actually the clergy visa, although you don't technically have to, you just have to work for a religious organization to kind of visa. So those are the people who were having difficulty. So it's a small number of people. It's not like Israel is banning Christians. And then the other thing is that, like, this is something, like, Huckabee sent the letter on Wednesday, and the problem was solved on Sunday. Like, literally, it came out like in the media, like on a Friday, and Sunday morning I started working. I'm trying to come with a follow-up news story. And like within 2 hours of me starting to call people, they were like, the problem is solved to our satisfaction. So had it not been leaked to the media, no one would know about this. It would be a very small group of people who had a problem with the visas, and the problem would have been resolved. Right. And one has to wonder, like, who has the interest in leaking that to the media? Like, I, as a reporter, if when someone leaks something to me, I have to think about what the person's interest is and try to verify, et cetera, because you know that people leakers have an interest, right? Leakers have a reason to leak something. And I do wonder, I do feel like this is a time that people are trying to sort of make, create a wedge between Israel and Christians. Certainly you have all of these social media figures, some of whom we talked about last week on the far right, who have become really anti-Israel, and they try to use their Christianity as a way to, as a reason to be anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. But on the other hand, I think Israel needs to be a lot smarter. There was an analysis of Israel by Laser Berman where he suggested that Israel have a sort of Christian point person or some sort of office or something to deal with these specific issues. I mean, Israel has the Ministry of Religious Affairs, right? But that more deals with funding for churches and for religious services for Israelis of all religions, but including the Christians that have major communities in Israel. I think that it's sort of should be something maybe within the foreign ministry or maybe within the prime minister's office. It's, you know, most of the Zionists in this world are Christians, and most of the time they get along fine with Israel. Very well with Israel even, but there have been issues and persistent issues over time, like, I don't know, harassment, but there have been cases of harassment that have happened repeatedly, say it's a handful of times a year, but they get very big headlines. And instead of, you know, responding and playing defense all the time, Israel should be more proactive in trying to head them off.
Absolutely, I agree. Israel should do what is necessary to be welcoming to Christian supporters of Israel and to clamp down on the instances that did occur. The one thing I would like to add, and I know this might be a little bit politically incorrect, but I think we're allowed to be a little bit politically incorrect on the show. As you know, I studied the BDS movement very closely for a number of years. And in many cases, the leaders of the Palestinian BDS movement were actually Christian Palestinians. And I think the reason for that is because they needed a way to show their Palestinian nationalism, their belonging to the Palestinian collective. They couldn't take part in sort of the Islamist, Muslim, Sunni fighting for Al-Aqsa narrative because that wasn't part of their religious story. So the way that they could prove their nationalism and their belonging was by becoming leaders in the cause to delegitimize and demonize and boycott Israel. That's one point they get as a background. The other thing that needs to be taken into account, and this is even maybe more a little bit politically incorrect, but should be noted, is that a number of the churches, the denominations in Israel, and I don't get into the details, talk about which particular churches, are involved in sometimes acrimonious legal proceedings vis-a-vis Israel related to taxation and municipal duties and property rights. And while when I was in government, we were someone involved in trying to solve some of these issues. And some of them really come down, it's not about church property, it's about economic, it's about hotels or other economic properties that they don't want to have be taxed, or I don't want to get into the details. But in some ways, these long-running disputes between Israel and some of the denominations also, I think, sometimes impact their statements in the international media, international arena regarding Israel.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a difference between like the local homegrown Orthodox church, and then there's the Catholics, which have also different like relations vis-a-vis Israel. I mean, like if we were going on a scale from bad roads to good relations, like the worst Orthodox church has constantly in conflict with Israel because that's what the Palestinian Christians are. And second, because of this whole tax issue, they don't want to pay municipal taxes, property taxes in Jerusalem, basically. And like the municipality doesn't want to make them, they don't have to pay tax on churches themselves, but they're also the largest property owner in Jerusalem, and properties that churches, they think they should be. That's the issue in a nutshell. Then there's the Catholic Church, right, which I would say has medium good relations with Israel. The Cardinal Pizzaballa, I think, has very pretty good relations with Israel, actually. And then there's the evangelicals, who there's not so many of them who live in Israel, but they're coming here and visiting all the time, and they're huge supporters of Israel, right? And that's like sort of, you know, we're talking about Huckabee, talking about the Christian Zionists. Like most of them are from the evangelical community, and I think that Israel. Look, Israel needs to, you know, treat all religions fairly. But I think like the issue or where the issue that it seemed like was coming up in the last week over people souring on Israel came from Catholics and evangelicals outside of Israel. The final thing that I would say, which is I think a lot harder, a really difficult needle to thread, is that Israel has laws restricting missionary activity, not only Christians, but it mostly applies to Christians. I think these laws come out of deep historic sensitivity to the fact that Jews were not just felt threatened, but were threatened by Christian missionary activities over, you know, since the Byzantine, you know, like almost 2000. And Jews shouldn't have to be with that when we are living in the Jewish state. However, Christians view missionizing as an inherent part of their religion, right? They believe that it is their job to share the good news, quote unquote, with the world. And we're also talking in a lot of cases about American evangelicals who, you know, have a deeply held value of free speech. I also very much believe strongly in the First Amendment and free speech. And so they think that they should be allowed to say whatever they want to say. I agree with both sides here in the sense, right? Like I think, you know, Israelis should not have to deal with missionary activity in the Jewish state. Like there should be one country in the world where we're safe from this, of whether it's Christian missionaries or people who want to convert Jews to Islam or any other religion. But it is also a speech issue, and it's a really tough needle to thread. And that has also come out. In 2023, there were Haredi Knesset members who wanted to try to have even stricter laws, and Netanyahu blocked that, which I think was the right move. I mean, there's already laws on the books, and we don't need to harass our greatest supporters or antagonize them even more.
Lev, can you give us a brief update about what's happening in Israeli politics? People are leaving the government, leaving the coalition, leaving their positions, returning to their positions, leaving their positions again, threatening to vote against. What's going on? Are we heading towards the government falling? Are we heading towards elections? What's your take on it?
Okay, so the first thing I have to say is don't panic. Nothing's going to happen, at least until October. And the reason for that is the Knesset is going into recess in a week. Netanyahu did not actually lose his majority. You have like Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, going around saying Netanyahu has a minority government now. A minority government means a government that's supported by a minority of the Knesset. Right now, Netanyahu is and his government are supported by 61 seats in the Knesset. The United Torah Judaism, which is the Ashkenazi Haredi bloc, they have left the government and the coalition. So they are no longer, so the coalition dropped from 68 seats to 61 seats. Shas, which is the Sephardic Haredi party, they quit 4 out of their 5 ministerial posts. So at first all 5 quit. And then one of them said, no, I have really important things to do. And he came back, which makes you wonder why were we paying the other 4 guys' salaries if what they were doing is not so important. But they said they're not going to vote against the coalition. So Netanyahu has a 61 seat majority coalition. His government is not falling apart just yet. Now, why is any of this happening? Why did UTJ quit? Why did 4 out of 5 Shas ministers quit? Oh, the other thing with Shas is that Aryeh Deri is going to run an observer in the security cabinet. Aryeh Deri, who is not a minister, but is somebody that Netanyahu trusts, despite Deri having multiple corruption convictions under his belt, Netanyahu trusts him. And so he has been sort of sitting in all of the security cabinet meetings throughout this war. So that will continue as well. So Shas is not giving up on the things they care the most, not the interior ministry, which is, you know, one of the ministries that gets the most government funding, and not on being in the security cabinet. In any case, the reason for all of this is because of the Haredi draft. There's been multiple Supreme Court rulings that Israel must draft Haredi men into the IDF. And the government has tried to avoid it in all different ways. And basically, they have to penalize, like anybody else, anyone who dodges the draft. Raidan want there to be a bill to be passed so that the penalties are not the same as anyone else. Right now, it's like you don't draft, you go to jail, and there's like certain other smaller things that happen. The government is supposed to stop funding their yeshivas also, because, you know, under the current situation, under the law where there's no legal exemption for Haredim from the draft anymore, the yeshivas are basically encouraging people to break the law. And the Haredim wanted to that sort of reduce these penalties. They care the most about the lack of funding for yeshivas. Second to them are penalties, individual penalties, like you can't get a driver's license, you can't leave the country, you might go to jail. The head of the Casa Foreign Affairs and Defense Ministry, Yuli Osin, tried to come to some sort of deal with them. But like essentially the Haredim want there to be no penalties. They want Haredi men to be able to learn Torah full time and not join the war effort in which more manpower is desperately needed. They don't want to be part of the defense of the country that they live in, period. And so it's become like sort of intractable. They're not really willing to compromise, right? What they want to do is kick the can down the road. Like, oh, we can have a law that will only go into, you know, that will only be applied to anyone basically in 2 years. And Edelstein is saying that's unacceptable. And if you look at the polls, the Israeli people say it's unacceptable too, including the people who are voting for Likud, for the right wing, for the parties in this coalition that are not Haredi. Likud, the religious Zionist party, Otzma. Those voters, first of all, overwhelmingly serve in the army, including in combat units, especially in religious Zionism. And they want the Haredim to enlist or to be conscripted. So the Knesset is going into recess next week, as I said. No law could really be passed until October anyway. And so this gives Netanyahu now a lot of time to try to reach a compromise. But also, as I said, contrary to some of the more sensational headlines, his coalition hasn't fallen apart yet.
Never a dull second in Israel. We've talked a lot about what's going on in Israel, but now let's go to our guest, Ruth Wasserman Lande, who will give us a tour of what's happening along all of Israel's borders. And again, there are things too, even what looks, many things aren't quiet, and even what looks quiet isn't so quiet. So as again, Ruth Wasserman Lande served in Israel's foreign ministry for many years, including as deputy ambassador in Egypt. She served as international affairs and Jewish affairs advisor to Israel's former president, Shimon Peres. She served as a member of Knesset in the opposition from the Blue and White Party, the party led by Benny Gantz. And today, she serves as an advisor and a speaker both to the West and with various Jewish and pro-Israel groups, also as an Arabic speaker, a prominent voice for Israel in the Arabic media. And she serves as a senior fellow at the Misgab Institute. Ruth Wasserman Lande, it is such a pleasure to have you on the Misgav Mideast Horizons podcast, and especially now when the Middle East is changing so rapidly and what you're focusing on in the morning is different than what we're focusing on the afternoon and the evening. And this could be confusing for some people, some outside observers. What do you think people in the West or around the world often get wrong in terms of understanding the Middle East today and understanding the current conflicts that Israel is in?
So first of all, it's a pleasure for me to be with you on this podcast. Thank you for having me. The first and foremost thing that I think there is a misunderstanding about, which I think is quite a significant one, and many Israelis also fall into that trap, and that is the rhetoric and the narrative that is being specifically thrown out there for us by those who have an interest in distorting the real picture. And that is the extremist Islamists on both sides, whether Shiite or Sunni. I view the conflict not an Israeli-Palestinian one, not as a Jewish-Muslim conflict, nor as an Israeli-Arab conflict. In fact, we are talking about a relatively very, very different prism of looking at things, which is the extremist Islamist Shiite axis versus that of the Sunni extremist Islamists. And those two axes are actually in competition with one another, recreate Islamic worldwide caliphate based on Sharia, with Shiite or Sunni, depending on which side is leading. And in between that, in the midst of that huge competition, lies the world or the globe, which is the arena which is to become that extremist Islamist caliphate from the point of view of those who are promoting it. And I know it sounds a little bit far-fetched, but one needs to just examine the dormant cells and those that are less dormant and already active, of Islamist cells, whether they're Shiite and some of them are Sunni in the European Union, in other countries in Europe, in the United States of America, in Canada, in Australia. Many of those have awoken after October 7th, but not all of them. So that's what I think is the main misconception currently, I think the most significant one.
That sort of brings up a question for me, at least, that in the multiple fronts that Israel has been fighting since October 7th, there's extremist Sunnis and extremist Shiites, and to some extent working together, though not as well as Hamas would have wished, but right, like Hamas is Sunni, Hezbollah and Iran are Shiites. We're unclear what will happen in Syria moving forward, but that's also Sunni, at least the Jalani is Sunni. So it's sort of like they're competing for primacy in the region and perhaps the world, but they all seem to agree about Israel.
Yes, so unfortunately, the hatred and the, I would say, the zealousness, the religious zealousness, which they base on the Quran and Islam, is that the Jews and Israel need to be annihilated from the Shiite point of view in order for their Messiah, Mahdi, to come back. Which is clearly what they say in Farsi, sometimes even in Arabic. And the Sunni extremist Islamists, whether they are led by Erdogan or supported by Erdogan, like Julani, or whether they're Hamas or other Sunni extremists, all say that Israel needs to go. But that is not the end game for them. In other words, Israel and or this so-called two-state solution and the Palestinian national identity is not a rhetoric or a narrative which is the one that has been adopted by religious extremist Sunni and or Shiite groups. In fact, if one listens correctly, and they're very open about it in Arabic, and especially in Arabic, they say very, very openly, their end game is a worldwide caliphate based on Sharia. Israel is very important on the path to that. In other words, because we are in Dar al-Islam. We are on land that is so-called in the region where Islam needs to rule rather than Judaism and or Israelis and so on. But this is not the end game at all by any means. By the way, Egypt falls into that, Jordan falls into that in terms of the land. There shouldn't be in their eyes a secular or non-Islamist government like there exists in Egypt and or Jordan. There needs to be an extremist Islamist, whether it's Sunni or Shia, depending on whom you ask, a caliphate led by whomever it is that is ruling. So yes, that's the idea. And Israel is of particular interest also, not only because the Jews are mentioned in the Quran, depending on when you read, where you read in the Quran, the beginning or the end. In the beginning, we're people of the book and we should be honored. In the second half, we should be annihilated and we should be converted to Islam, by the way, just like Christians.
And that just, I mean, I would say just like Christians sort of reflects historic reality in which they tried to convert the Jews and then couldn't. No, like it just, they started writing it at one point, they finished writing it at another point.
Precisely. In fact, the Quran, there is a very clear, I would say, division or a difference. In the first part, there was a more favorable kind of attitude towards the Jews, while there was an attempt to convert and to overtake and to convince. When that didn't take place, it almost seems as if there was a shift in the perception and a different kind of attitude was taken, and of course it was a very negative one. But so Israel has another diamond in that basket, which is very much looked upon by the Islamists as something that is to be had. And that is, of course, Jerusalem and the holy places, which is a very big take or asset with which to galvanize support amidst the rest of the Muslims in the world.
You mentioned Egypt and Jordan, which have been a little bit less in focus. The focus has been in Syria and Gaza, but in fact, they are two of Israel's most largest and most important neighbors. And there are deeper trends happening in those countries, which are, I think, concerning. How do you see Egypt today? You served as deputy ambassador to Egypt. How do you see Egypt today? And you've also raised the concern of the Egyptian military buildup in the Sinai Desert. There are other people, some Israeli politicians who have been very dismissive of that, have counseled to sort of ignore it. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. So explain how you see Egypt-Israel relations today, whether there's potential for a warming of those relations, of improving those relations. We have peace for decades, but the relationship tend to be very cold, and whether or not we should be concerned about the Egyptian military buildup right on Israel's southern border.
So thank you very much for the question. I think that Egypt and Jordan are not enough on the radar of international players, role players, particularly in the United States, and on the radar screen of intelligence services. I think this is very, very important and very critical that this changes. And I'll explain why. I think that the Israeli-Egyptian strategic alliance is key and important and strategic and has been for years, perhaps even simply for the fact that there has not been a war. And there has been a lot of coordination on the intelligence level and so on. Having said that, we need to understand that when we talk about peace, it is viewed very differently from our point of view and the West point of view and that of either Jordan or particularly Egypt. It's not a peace that comprises normalization. Rather, it is a peace that is more an agreement, a kind of a security arrangement, perhaps even more than that, but not one that comprises people-to-people exchanges, warm ties, cultural exchanges, and so on. What first and foremost most worries me regarding Egypt throughout the years, by the way, but particularly since October 7th, is the incitement and the indoctrination of the Egyptian people, that is more than 110 million people, against Israel and the Jewish people. The indoctrination and the incitement in Egypt, I would dare say, is by far the worst in the entire Arab Sunni world. That's quite a statement to make. It is absolutely atrocious, horrendous, and Israel has done very little, if anything at all, to attempt even to ask the Egyptians to water this down or not even to mention change it.
That's very interesting because there's been a lot of focus, for example, on the issue of incitement in Palestinian textbooks and in Palestinian schools and summer camps and the glorification of terror and the glorification of terror attacks. But you're right, very little attention that's been given to Egypt. We have the positive examples, for example, from the UAE, Bahrain, even Saudi Arabia, exactly. Changes that have been made. But you're right, Egypt is something that's been very underemphasized, certainly by the West, but by Israel as well.
Absolutely. And there is a dancing around, a tiptoeing around Egypt, a very, very huge degree of cautiousness in terms of taking care not to hurt the Egyptian pride, the Egyptian national pride, and which is fine, up to a point where the incitement and the indoctrination is horrendous. There has been a small attempt which needs to be mentioned in the elementary schools in Egypt following the Abraham Accords. And that has been a positive attempt, but it has been stopped and on the contrary, become even worse throughout. And I'm talking about not only the curricula, the official education, the culture, the movies, the atmosphere in professional syndicates, the universities, and so on. And I just need to explain why that is so, so dangerous, because we're talking about masses of people, a significant degree of whom are illiterate, okay? And those particularly living very far from Cairo and the centers of cities. And there is a huge hatred nurtured, I would dare say, a little bit to divert attention away from a lot of the economic problems from within, the dislike of a lot of the people to the central government, and to try and divert attention towards this hatred of Israel and the Jews. But this is a very dangerous game, because it's not that they're killing their people to support terrorism, because that's against the main regime as well. That's a threat to the main and central government in Egypt. They just teach antagonism towards Israel and the Jews. But of course, the Egyptian government knows and understands, and of course, we should make the point that they're one and the same. And everybody in Egypt in the intelligence services knows that every antagonistic gathering against Israel, whether it's from a university or whatever, in the street, a demonstration or anything else, after 20 minutes become demonstrating against the central government. So they're playing with fire. They've been in this for years. The central government doesn't feel as if it has the strength to fight it. So not only does it not fight it, it feeds it, it nurtures it. And God forbid, if the street becomes, I would say, more volatile or less controlled by the central government, or if something goes wrong with the central government, or if there are outside forces influencing the central government, and I'll say a word about that in a minute, against the West and against Israel, this could be used as a very lethal tool. And I wouldn't at all, mark down the significance of this threat of this indoctrination and incitement. That's number one. Number two, there is, without a doubt, objectively, country buildup in Sinai. It's not a defensive buildup, it's an offensive buildup. Do I think that tomorrow there'll be a war with Egypt? No. But there is a buildup and a preparation for war with Israel. And this is something that cannot be overlooked.
When you said there's a buildup, can you just give a few examples of what that buildup looks like?
And since we already interrupted you, I'll add my question, which is that,
sure.
Why do you think that they're doing this, right? Like, there's a big difference between them not clamping down the incitement and them sort of actively taking steps that are antagonistic to Israel.
So this is a very interesting question, and I think it feeds into the main understanding, which is not a clear-cut black or white understanding, but rather that Egypt is it's sort of dancing on two weddings at the same time. And I'll explain. It has its eyes and compassions and empathy with the West, of course, the United States in particular, which is giving it a lot of money on an annual basis for many years since the peace agreement. But it also is looking to diversify means, economic means, and income, and particularly investment in infrastructure, which is very, very difficult. And it looks out to China. And recently, very, very concerningly, it has an infiltration of Qatar in Egypt, which absolutely nobody speaks about. Now, Qatar in Egypt, just to mention the dancing and two wedding kind of policy, is an enemy of Egypt. In fact, Al Jazeera was shut down endless times in Egypt because it went against the Egyptian regime, which is not Islamist, as opposed to that which Qatar obviously funds and supports. Qatar is known to fund the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an enemy of the Egyptian regime. And yet, because of, I would say, the objective, the stopping of funding from the Saudi Arabia to Egypt and the hinging of the relations with the United States, in the sense that not once and not twice money has been stopped to Egypt, Egypt was looking for diversifying other means of investment and income. And unfortunately, it has succumbed to a degree to Qatar and to Iran. And both of those entities have been sworn enemies. Iran, for example, Shiite entity, whereas Egypt is, of course, an almost wholly Sunni one, apart from the 20 or so percent of the Coptic Christian Egyptians. Iran was always viewed, Iran, I'm talking about the current regime, the Ayatollah regime Iran, at the Shah's Iran as an enemy. In fact, the Shah is buried in one of the most beautiful areas of central Cairo, in a very beautiful mausoleum, and that has been a source of irritation and annoyance. It was annoying to the Iranian regime. And Iran, of course, named Islambouli the murderer of former President Sadat as one of the main streets of Tehran. And yet, since October 7, there have been several very, very high-ranking delegations visiting Egypt and formulating some kind of an understanding. This has happened not once, not twice. And this is very interesting because there's a lot of Iranian involvement and Qatari involvement in Sudan, which is a region which is of huge, huge interest to Egypt in terms of geostrategic stability. And also, the Houthis are stopping the transportation of ships going to Egypt, which is a huge income potential for Egypt. And I believe that this is something to do with what they discussed with the Iranian current regime. And if you look at what Egypt has said following the 12-day war between Israel and Iran, it was the only Arab country in the region which not only condemned Israel, all of them did, but also right out stood next to Iran and supported Iran in this war, which is an interesting thing to note.
Do you think that the buildup in the Sinai is a result of this, like, pressure in from Qatar and Iran, or is there something else going on there?
So there are two things going on. One, there's definitely a buildup, diversifying other methods of economic investment and also sport, which is Iran, Qatar, China, and so on. But that's not the only thing. There is a very inherent underlying distrust and I would even say hatred of Israel on the part of many, not only in the street, but in the ruling echelon of Egypt. I am not sure that that pertains to the president himself, but I would dare say to high-ranking people in the Egyptian military and to people in the intelligence of Egypt. There's been tectonic changes in that intelligence structure in the since October 7th, in fact. And those, I would say, policymakers are influencing the perception of Israel as an imperialistic, colonialist, threatening entity. It's not that this has not existed before, but it certainly has grown, one, because of the influence of Iran, Qatar, and others, also because of the actual hatred, incitement, and indoctrination that the government itself is feeding into itself, which is a double-edged sword. And this was strengthened since October 7th. And this perception of Israel as an imperialist entity wants to expand and threaten Egypt, which is quite crazy to think about if one takes into account that we've actually given back the entire Sinai Peninsula and we're a teeny tiny country. So it is vastly impossible for me to comprehend, but it is in fact an inherent perception on the part of many decision makers, both in the political realm and in the military realm in Egypt. And this needs to be understood both by Israeli decision makers and the West.
Talking about perceptions in the Middle East, perceptions that have always long existed and that perhaps have been made even more prominent given Israel's military successes over the past 2 years, and certainly in the Rising Lion operation in Iran, it seems that many in the Arab world and in the West didn't understand why Israel intervened in southern Syria several days ago to protect the Jewish community. What did you tell your audiences in the Western and in the Arabic media to explain why Israel chose to intervene?
So this is a very, very, very important question, not only vis-a-vis the Israeli intervention in southern Syria, but in general. The Israeli government is putting zero effort into explaining what on earth it is doing. And that is vastly important, not only to the international arena, but also to the Arab world. And quite frankly, the Arab-speaking world is reading, watching, seeing, and being nurtured by endless narratives which are completely not in line with reality and have zero of the Israeli input. I'm not saying they should be fed the Israeli narrative, but nothing but the indoctrination of Qatari, Al Jazeera, and the a little bit less indoctrinated Al Arabiya and other networks. That's what the Arab-speaking world is watching. No wonder they think that Israel is an imperialistic, colonialist entity that wants to invade Syria, because that's what they watch, that's what they hear, and that's what they see, which is, of course, completely on a different path to what Israel is really doing. I mean, what I explain to those who are indeed willing to listen is that Israel has a brotherhood with the Druze population. We have a small but very significant Druze population in Israel. They participate in the IDF. Many of them have given their lives to protect the state of Israel in the current wars and in former wars. We have a real brotherhood. They're completely integrated into society, and their brothers and their family members have been not attacked, not threatened, not in clashes, minority clashes or ethnic clashes, as the West completely crazily put it, but they've been massacred just like our people were massacred on October 7. They've been gang raped, massacred, torched, and really carnaged by ISIS-like, if not ISIS, literally warriors supported by the Syrian government, which is in fact supported by Erdogan. So this has been happening under the nose of the entire Western world, with absolutely no one coming to the help of those minority groups, whether they're, by the way, Alawite, Muslim Syrians, whether they're Kurds, whether in this particular situation they're Druze. And only Israel came to their support, first and foremost, on a human, ethical, moral basis. But moreover, there is that perimeter or barrier that we've marked between Israel's northern border and Syria, that there was a tacit agreement overseen by the United States that Jalani's soldiers and army could not cross. And they did. And in fact, they crossed it and entered Saweda and the regions of those Jews who were massacred, including women and children and rapings and horrific undertakings. And Israel could not allow for the breach to take place, also for geostrategic security reasons, not because they wanted to take over Syrian land, but because they didn't want ISIS on its border instead of peaceful Jews. And that's something that has not been explained by the state of Israel to anybody in the Arab-speaking world, which is crazy to my understanding.
I'd like to broaden this out a bit and hear your thoughts, because I thought Israel handled this whole thing really badly. I think, first of all, unfortunately, right? Like, I wish the world cared about persecuted minorities, but I think the world really knows who the Druze are, and like that message didn't go over well, even if that's an important part of the reason Israel was in Syria. And maybe even the buffer zone and the security would have been the better message, like counterintuitively, right? Because everyone wants Israel, it complains about Israel not respecting human rights. Then counterintuitively, maybe the security would have gone over better. And then the other thing was, there was the strike in Damascus itself, which I sort of like have my doubts if that was the right way to go, right? Like maybe it would have been viewed internationally sort of more, less controversially, let's say, if the strikes were really in Ceuta on the people who were attacking the Druze, as opposed to making it look like something that might further destabilize the regime, which obviously is very clear the U.S. wants to stabilize this regime and, you know, the U.S. is our most important ally. So I guess I'm just wondering what you think Israel could have, should have handled this differently. Asher, also, this isn't like a traditional interview question. It's more of like a, we're all Misgav fellows, let's brainstorm. Or, well, Asher, you're the director, but yeah.
I have to agree that it's clear that Israel has often been lacking in its strategic communications with the Arab world. We're lucky that we have people like you who are able to communicate in Arabic and to go on Arabic media. But go ahead, Deegans, give your answer.
Okay, so there are perfect Arabic-speaking people in this country that are well-equipped with the tools with which to address the Arab world. The country just needs to prioritize this issue, and not only to the Arab world, but to the international arena. Now, should we focus our policies on what the world thinks? Of course not, because they'll hate us anyway, and they'll criticize us anyway. And there's a huge, huge, undeniable amount of hypocrisy on the part of the Western world. I mean, people are being massacred, killed, burnt, raped, and Israel is the one who's for human rule, which is pretty insane to my mind. And that is after we had been punished as well. And everybody understands that if God forbid our army does protect our civilians, that's what's going to happen to all of us in this tiny country. But anyway, we need to understand that the military effort alone, without communicating what we are doing to the West and to the Arab-speaking world, is no longer a possibility in the modern era. This is not something that is acceptable. We need to explain our point of view. There will be people who will at least hear another narrative. Currently, they just simply don't. So whether we bombed the palace or we didn't bomb the palace, and that made the world support or support us less or more, don't think that is the correct question. But absolutely, without a doubt, we will be explaining what on earth we're doing, particularly since I am really and truly convinced from an ethical point of view that we are in fact doing the right thing. Apart from that, to really address the issue of bombing the palace or not bombing the palace, and again, I'm not a spokesperson for this government. I served in the Knesset in the opposition, but I think and I believe that this was a signal to the current government. It wasn't a lethal signal, but it was definitely a signal that we understand that this particular government is in fact supporting this massacre, which is the truth. It is a politically incorrect truth. It's not something that stands in a very comfortable manner with what the West currently wants, because it wants Gulani to stabilize Syria. It wants the Turks to be happy because they currently support the energy routes from Turkmeny countries all the way potentially to the West, because now they have Syria. But Gulani will not stabilize Syria. Gulani is part of the problem. He's not strong enough, unfortunately, to support Syria. And basically what the West is doing, perhaps out of innocence to some degree, is supporting a terrorist regime that doesn't have enough control over terrorist groups, power-hungry, crazy groups like ISIS that are going to ravage Syria. That's what's going to happen. And Israel can simply not afford to have those on its border directly. And whether it is explained, which is not, by my government, or it is not explained, this is, in fact, what needs to be done. And yes, the current government in Syria needs to understand and comprehend the seriousness of this red line, which is, I believe, the reason why the palace was bombed gently this time.
I think that you're absolutely right that in the West, very often there are certain cookie cutter ways of looking at realities in the region. So in the view of many in the West, you had a rebel group, they took over, and now the most important thing is for them to stabilize the country, and are they willing to enact reforms and work with the West and get investment and create opportunities? And the reality of many of the Middle East, and of certainly of a country like Syria, of the millennia-old conflicts between various groups, between Sunnis and Druze in southern Syria, that struggle for power and control of the strategic highlands in southern Syria, and the support of the current regime for the Sunnis, in this case Bedouin Sunnis, who are fighting the Druze and are sort of taking advantage of that opportunity now to extend their control over the strategic areas, is a complex and in some ways uncomfortable reality, which unfortunately just perhaps many in the West looking from the outside fail to understand. And like you said, Israel needs to look very clear-sighted, realist view at the reality and take its actions in accordance with that. So we've discussed Egypt, we've discussed Syria. I want to also talk about Israel's neighbor to the east, Jordan, which was generally considered a quiet border, but I think you came with us when we toured the Jordan border. We saw how open it was, how easy it was to move from Jordan to Israel. I can tell you that on the first day of Israel's operation in Iran, I got a message from my reserve unit saying, be prepared to be sent to the Jordanian border. We don't know what's going to develop there. We weren't sent to the end, but there was a real fear of Iranian militias, local militias, terrorists taking part in that attack. So if you can tell us a little bit about what you see is happening in Jordan and how that affects Israel's security and stability in the region.
Asha, I'd just like to say, with your permission, one last sentence concerning Syria. And that is that the Jolani government is interested in portraying the current infighting as Bedouin Druze clashes. But many of the fighters were not, in fact, Bedouins, but rather Syrians that were either paid or sent by the government of Syria, and basically belong to either ISIS groups or other groups that are those that brought this government into its current position in the first place. So if it is portrayed as sectarian, internal Syrian fighting, which, by the way, has been going on for decades. Yes, it's not like infighting has not been happening in almost every country, Middle East, for ages. And the world goes on because it can't be involved in a single sectarian clash in the region. But it's much more than that. And that's what we need to highlight to the West and to our neighbors in the region. By the way, if anybody understands this, it's our neighbors in the region, like, for example, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and they get it. They get it. As the West less. But to go to Jordan, 336 kilometers of mutual border, which is completely unguarded and has not been guarded since the peace agreement, for sure. There's approximately, I believe, 50 kilometers of a very low fence, which is literally nothing at all. And of course, there's a fear of galvanizing and incentivizing local Palestinians and Bedouins on the Jordanian side to simply cross into Israel. Also, there's the issue of those ISIS supporters from Syria and other places to simply cross to Jordan as well. And there's been an attempt by the West to better protect the Lebanese Syrian border, amongst other things, for that particular purpose, to prevent the crossing over of extremist factors via Lebanon, via Syria, via Jordan, amongst other places, to Israel. But yes, this is a very, very unprotected border. It has been protected by the Hashemite kingdom that has no interest in destabilizing the kingdom and in creating a war with Israel whatsoever, because clandestinely it's supported by Israel and supported by the United States. But again, this double-edged sword of incentivizing, inciting, and indoctrinating the population against Israel and the Jews has been in place for many, many years, thereby creating a very comfortable climate or atmosphere in which these kind of extremist views can very easily become actionable terrorist activities. So it's very easy to make this incitement into terrorism if there is a very systematic attempt to do so. Now, the Ayatollah Khomeini regime in Iran has been trying to do so for years. In fact, it has been nurturing Hamas in the Hashemite kingdom for years. It has also found graves, so-called Shiite graves, to tend to in Jordan, all of a sudden, in Sunni Jordan, and they happen to be very close to the Israeli-Jordanian border, so they have to take care of those graves. This has been in effect for years and has not been on the radar screen of almost any research center or policymaker in the West. And there's been a huge attempt to infiltrate Jordan by the Islamic regime of Iran for years. And the Jordanian Hashemite kingdom knows this. It has been doing nothing against it until October 7th, when it became too much. How so? Their airspace was in fact used, or the Iranians tried to use it to attack Israel, and the Jordanians said, this is a red line. We don't want a war with Israel. We have no interest in a war. Israel, you will not use or misuse our territory. And we put our foot down. And that's the first time that publicly the king actually went out and said no to the Islamic Republic of Iran. No. Not only did the Iranian regime take up arms, so to speak, against the Hashemite kingdom in that manner, it did it in a very sophisticated manner that is on a completely different front, and that's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How so? In fact, it put a lot of energy in inciting Hamas, Islamic Jihad in East Jerusalem and amidst the Palestinians, either in Gaza and or the West Bank, to sort of try and take ownership over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Every single Ramadan, there was an attempt by these hooligans to take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Who's in charge of the Al-Aqsa Mosque? The Jordanian Hashemite kingdom. So they were trying to steal, in a very sophisticated manner, the ownership of the Hashemite kingdom over the centuries over and the protection of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and give it to these Sunni extremist Islamists. And what did the Hashemite kingdom do throughout the years during those Ramadan months? Yell louder against Israel. It didn't take a stand against the Islamic regime. But this changed after October 7th, as I said. And now, publicly, the Jordanians actually took the stand and are against the infiltration of the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iranians even offered to have militia sent to Jordan to help them stabilize this instability, which the Iranians themselves have created and supported, which is what the Iranians do. They destabilize the arena and then they infiltrate and take over. They've done that in Syria before the current regime took over with Assad. They've done that in Jordan. They've done that in Yemen. They've done that in Sudan. They've done that in many places. And they were trying to do that in Jordan and, by the way, in Egypt too. They were just not successful in Egypt because the security forces were too strong for them. And they were relatively successful until October 7th happened in Jordan. And that's the Jordanian arena. Do we have an understanding with the Hashemite kingdom, a clandestine one? Yes. They're not interested in undermining the stability of their own regime, and they understand that instability leaking to Israel will certainly undermine their regime. Is it enough? No. They need to be strengthened, and also Israel needs to make a stand. For the first time, with Jordan and with Egypt, via the United States of America, to stop and to diminish gradually the incitement and the indoctrination, which is horrific to the mass population.
All right, Ruth. Well, thank you so much for being with us. You are interesting as always. You have great insights on Israel's neighbors. Yes, and I always love to hear what you have to say about these topics.
Thank you. I'm
really glad you were here, and we hope to have you back.
Thanks so much, Anna, for see you soon.
Thank you for listening. Please make sure to follow the Miskav Institute at www.miskavins.org. Follow us on X, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube. Make sure to like and subscribe to our podcast. And you can send your comments and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. That's MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. See you next time.